CliffCentral.com.
CliffCentral.com and a little Post Malone. Get your day started. We've got lots and lots of very cool questions coming in already. You can send us yours if you have anything for the Burning Platform, which is coming up next. That is the Burning Platform, which is brought to you by Nando's, and we'd love to hear from you this morning. Tell us what's going down. We got Canthan joining us. We've got Pumi, and we've got you, and we'll also be joined this morning by Davi Skultz, who is a South African researcher. He is also an economic researcher at one of the South African political parties. He's completed his MBA, currently is working as a full-time management consultant, among other things. What's going on there in the background? Is there someone having a party?
I was trying to peg it. I thought it was
almost
from your side after the song.
No, it almost sounds like someone is in a restaurant or something. Who's there?
Is this Pumi's command center?
Yeah, because I've just muted her and it stopped.
I can hear you.
What have you got? What have you got going on there, Pums? It sounds like you've got activity in the background. Is there music playing and stuff?
Oh.
Huh? Pumi? Can you hear us?
Sounds like your command center.
Now we can't hear Pumi. So what's going on?
She just muted her.
This is the life of the 21st century and post-lockdown reality. Let's see if she can come back now. Pums, can you hear us? All right.
I'll help her offline.
Thank you very much, Sia. Much to discuss this morning. I would love to hear your thoughts and your ideas around not only what's going on in the US, because that's clearly the world's biggest story at the moment. But while we've got Davi this morning, I also want to talk to him about Finance Minister Tito Mboweni, who on Wednesday defended his decision to hire former TISO Black Star journalist Ranjeni Moonsami. Of course, that was also a big story in last week's Burning Platform. But as Canthan said at the time, who cares? There are much, much bigger things going on, and the EFF are the ones who've demanded that he explain himself. We've reached the fiscal cliff that economists have been warning about for the past 6 years. Parliament has been told that, no less. So this is not just the opinion of economists and outsiders anymore. Now it is the opinion of Parliament. And that's according to the Fiscal Cliff Study Group. They've actually started a group for this. And that point is obviously reached because they can calculate it. When civil servant salaries, social grant payments, and debt service costs soak up all government revenue. That is a reality that we have to discuss too. So I thought while we've got Davi on this morning, we'll talk to him. Pums, can you hear us now?
Yeah, I can.
Just quickly,
just
for the benefit of those people who are still curious, just very briefly, tell us about your incident with the bank, because I'm getting a lot of questions from people who want to know.
So, you know, you have to social distance everywhere.
Yes.
So the queues at the bank are ridiculous. After spending an hour at one bank and then having to go to another bank because that's where my branch is, Hanahana, standing in the social distanced queue outside the bank at 25 past 3, I was wondering what's going to happen to us, right? Are they going to, like, say it's 3:30, everybody, goodbye, come back tomorrow.
Yeah.
But they weren't. They came out to take everybody's names so that whoever was still in the queue at 3:30 would still be serviced. Only for this woman to tell me that they actually, you have to make an appointment. I have to make an appointment to get the service that you actually require.
But Pumi, can I ask you something?
I had to stop speaking in Zulu. I had to bring out the Karen. I was like,
right, you became a Zulu
now
Karen.
I'm bringing out my higher grade English.
What is
give us a sample. Let's hear what it sounds like.
Hang on, before that even, Canthan, what is the Zulu equivalent of a Karen? Like, what's a name that a Zulu woman might have if she was a Karen?
Ooh, I'd have to think about that. I'm not sure.
Come on.
I'm not sure, but there is one. I had to bring, when you have to make a decision, right? You have to make a decision if you bring out ghetto Pumi, or if you bring out super private school for me. I had to bring out the private school for me, and I was just like, listen, gotta get me the manager. I'm closing my bank account. You gotta give me my entire 52 rand and 23 cents in cash right now.
So this
over the counter.
This might be an embarrassing question for you to answer, but I haven't been to my branch of my bank for 22 years. So what the hell made you have to go there?
I lost my card.
Oh, God. All right. How embarrassing.
I lost my card. Oh. I actually have no idea who my business banker is, because this is how bad the service at my bank is.
Which bank is that, Pumi?
Yeah, name and shame.
Name and shame. Standard Bank. It was terrible.
Okay.
It was terrible. I had to actually say, like, I'm going to close my 10-year-old account and just give me my entire 52 rand and 23 cents over the counter right now. I'll open an account at FNB.
Oh, my God. All right, let's move on.
It's been resolved. I now know who my banker is.
I'm very aware of the fact that we've only got Davi until 7:30, so I don't want to waste any more time. Davi, it's very nice to have you on the Burning Platform this week. The Burning Platform, as every week, is brought to you by Nando's. And this morning, Pumi and Kanthan are joined by Davi Skultz. So, Davi, let's just hop straight in. First of all, how has lockdown been for you? I know you're an analyst of all things statistical. So have you picked up any useful information that has wowed you over the last couple of months that would surprise any of us when it comes to lockdowns, corona, and potential effects on the elections, which I know you have an obsession with like me?
Yes. Hi, Gareth. Morning, everyone. Look, to be honest, it's been a crazy year from a work perspective for me, right? So actually, people who have like normal office jobs and who have had to work from home this year, I don't know, I think lots of the listeners will be able to sympathize, but it's just like you work crazy extra amount of hours. So it's actually been, from an analytical perspective, a sadly empty year. I've had to like really make some time in the last month or so to try to think about the election and prepare for the election a little bit, and also prepare for our election next year. But no, I don't think I have more special analysis to share about corona that you may probably not know about already.
Well, let's then turn our attention to what is the obvious story of the world at the moment, and it is the US election. So, Kanthan, I got a message from Tobile earlier, and I always love it when people challenge us on the show, because we don't want this to become like those echo chambers that you see in the mainstream media. So people are saying you and I should be eating humble pie because of our predictions. And Pumi, you also predicted this last week, as I recall, that Donald Trump was going to outright win this. There wouldn't be such a close race in so many places, and that those states which we...
No. Let's be very clear. What I said very clearly was that the polls were way off.
Okay.
And I made predictions with regard to very specific states. And those are all the states that are in contention right now. And those very specific issues are being resolved through matters of the courts at this moment. So remember the last prediction that I made on Twitter, which was probably pretty much in the morning yesterday, mm-hmm. was I predicted that he was going to end up taking Michigan and Wisconsin and Georgia and North Carolina. And if he ended up taking those, then he would not need Pennsylvania. Pennsylvania has not been counted yet, so we're still waiting on that. But remember that what's happened right now in Michigan specifically is that there's suddenly 130,000 votes in favor of Biden that popped up from nowhere. Now, this was very strange, okay? Suddenly you have an injection of 130,000 pro-Biden votes, but it's all... You know, it's not like a new batch of votes that has just come in and Biden has 95% of them. It's 130,000 votes for Biden.
And he has 100%.
No votes in that lot for Trump. No votes in that lot for Jorgensen. No votes for Kanye West. So
what do you think? Davi, you watch elections, and I know Pumi's got things to say here too, but you watch elections. If 130,000 votes, I thought it was 107, but it's obviously gone up, suddenly arrived for one person, and they were 100% for one person, and most of them were mail-in. Would you say that that is slightly suspicious, or is there nothing to see here?
There's nothing to see here. We know exactly the amount of mail-in ballots that arrived before the election. Mm-hmm. It's very carefully tracked. Everyone understands exactly how many mail-in ballots were arrived, where they came from, who sent them, what the party registration of those people were. The ballots get counted and loaded into the system. Occasionally, the ballots get counted actually in support batches, right? So sometimes when there's like 250,000 ballots in a warehouse that are being processed, sometimes the system reports all 250 in one go, Sometimes the system reports 120,000 for Trump in one go, and then 5 minutes later, 130,000 for Biden in one go. There are examples from last night where Trump, for example, got 100,000 jump vote here and 100,000 jump vote there.
Which states were those examples of, Davi?
I remember seeing in Wisconsin, people were complaining about this as well. There are these graphs, right? And then I think I remember Jonathan Witt tweeting it, actually. It was like, the cheating began here, and then there was like a little jump for Biden up, like just Biden votes coming up. But then if you look at the Trump graph down earlier in the evening, there are like little straight lines for Trump throughout the evening as well. So it's basically in Wisconsin, in Michigan, in Pennsylvania, et cetera. So look, firstly, I'm not like an in-detail election observer on the ground in America, so I wouldn't be able to say with absolute
absolutely the same on my side.
To me, there is no evidence of any kind of problematic things going on in America right now.
All right.
If you also look at the outcome of the election results, county by county, right? There's no county where it's like, oh, this is strange. There's 150,000 more votes here than should be here, or Hillary lost this county by 20% last time, but now Biden's winning it by 50%. Where did all these random ballots come from? Well, there's nothing like that from a casual observer perspective, which is really worrying to me.
Well, what might be interesting, and this is where you can again set us right if we're wrong, huge, huge turnout by comparison with 2016. That is significant. And I think in this election, it might turn out that whoever wins had the largest turnout of any president, and in popular vote terms, it will probably be Biden anyway on the popular vote. Yeah. That's quite noteworthy, especially in places in the Rust Belt like Michigan, Wisconsin, Ohio, Pennsylvania. Those are places where the election's always hotly contested, and they had tremendous turnout on both sides.
Like monstrous turnout. Like this has been an absolute monster turnout election. Definitely true. And particularly like monster turnout on both sides. Mm. So I went through on election night and, last 24 hours, like really going county by county, having a look at it, right? And looking at the red counties, right? Where Trump won, where he just like super overperformed. Like there's like rural counties in Ohio that he would like have won by say like 75-25, right, in the last election, and it's a small county, so he nets like 10,000 votes out of it, right?
Yeah.
Then you go to that county now and it's like 82-18, right? So the margin has gone up, but then he nets like 15,000 or 16,000 votes out of it because the turnout is way up as well. And that effect is all over the country. So the red counties all look like that. Like not all, but like a lot of them look like that. But then the blue counties are also just like enormous, enormous, enormous Democratic turnout as well, all over the place. And I don't look, I mean, for example, in Pennsylvania, right, in Philadelphia, which is kind of like ground zero now for deciding the election, which, by the way, I do think will go to Biden. We'll talk about that in a moment. But like, it looks like in Philadelphia, Hillary netted like 480,000 votes out of Philadelphia, right?
You're talking about the city, or you're talking about the state of Pennsylvania?
No, the city of Philadelphia, like actually the county of Philadelphia.
Yeah, the city of Philadelphia is the biggest player in this.
Right.
Yeah, and Hillary netted like 480,000 votes out of that county. I think at the current trajectory, Biden's probably going to net like 550,000 votes out of that county. Wow. So this is like the counterbalance to the small little county that I just spoke about, where Trump gets like plus 15 instead of plus 10, and then you add that up across the whole state, right? The counter to that is like the city of Philadelphia, Biden gets 550, nets 550 versus Hillary got 480 out of the city or something.
How many people vote in South Africa in the last election, the presidential and, well, what we call it in this country, the national elections?
Percentage-wise, turnout.
How many people turn out in South Africa to vote in our who did in our last election?
Like 67% turnout. We have 29 million registered voters. So what? It's something like 17 or 18 million people, I think.
Okay, 17, 18 million people. That's amazing. That's like if you take California, Florida, and Texas together. That's roughly the number of people. That's quite something.
Well, Florida was over 10 million turnout. So like, it's like Florida plus another like medium sized state, basically.
Okay. Yeah. Maybe Florida and, Illinois or whatever, but that's interesting. So your prediction then is that everything has got on track for a Biden win. I mean, the Trump people are claiming Pennsylvania as theirs. They're also claiming Georgia and, North Carolina, but that wouldn't be enough to get them the votes. Alaska obviously is also still going to come in because it's so far to the west, but that's not enough. That's 200.
Yeah, Alaska's only 3 votes or something like that.
Yeah, that's correct.
Yeah.
So
absolutely right. Pennsylvania is going to be critical to this, and it does all hinge on what happens in the urban centers, specifically Philadelphia.
Look, I think so. Prediction is a strong word, but I really do think that Wisconsin and Michigan teams is very, very likely to go to Biden now, right? And I think Wisconsin's actually been called properly. Michigan as well, like he's got a strong lead. I don't see a path for Biden for Trump to come back in Michigan. Pennsylvania is really interesting, right? So I think what Trump is currently leading by 160,000 votes, like as of now in Pennsylvania, right? If everything kind of tallies up as we think it should, then out of Philadelphia, kind of Biden should come out with a 550,000 vote lead. He currently has a 340,000 vote lead in Philadelphia. So in Philadelphia alone, there's going to come another 210, right? And Trump has a 160 lead. So that's plus 50 for Biden just out of Philadelphia. Then is the suburbs around Philadelphia, I've done the math. I think it's another like 10 to 20,000 votes in the suburbs around Philadelphia for Biden, like margin. So that's plus 60, plus 70 for Biden. And these are based on like very like conservative assumptions. But then there's like another, I think if you look across the state, like batches of rural conservative votes still to come in, which nets Trump, I think, like another plus 50. So the math I just did was like plus 60, plus 70 on very, very conservative assumptions for Biden, minus another 50 for Trump. So like under, I think, a super conservative scenario, like Biden takes it by 10 to 20,000 votes. But I mean, the modelers seem to think that it's going to be Biden by way bigger than that. Because the other thing is that votes that are still to come in are all mail-in ballots, which have been disproportionately Democratic. I've assumed on my calculations, actually, that the votes still to come in run the same run rate as the ones that are already in, which is, I think, way more conservative for Biden than it will end up being.
Just explain what you mean by that, Doug, the same run rate.
So if you, for example, look at a random county in rural Pennsylvania, right, and currently Trump is winning at 70-30, then I've assumed the votes that are still to come in will split 70-30, right? But in actual fact, the votes that are still to come in are mail-in ballots. It's from a conservative area, so mail-in ballots from a conservative area. But we know the few Democrats that actually live in that conservative area are more likely to have voted by mail. So those mail-in ballots are probably going to be more like 50-50 or 60-40 or 60-40 in Biden's favor and not the 70-30. And in this calculation I just did, which ended in Biden winning by about 20,000 votes, I assumed they split 70-30 for Trump when they're actually going to be more Democratic than that, I think. So I think it's highly likely Biden wins Pennsylvania, given the current trajectory and therefore the election.
Pumi?
Yeah, I tend to agree with that assessment. And, I do know that Trump is now taking Wisconsin for a recount because the margin is less than a percent. And so in terms of the rules in the U.S., you can ask for a recount if the margins are that close. So, Wisconsin obviously is going to go through the whole recount process. But, yeah, given that Philadelphia is this massive Democratic stronghold, you know, it'll have to see whether they've actually matched the turnout that they did last time in Philadelphia specifically.
Pums, you have been watching like I have, and I'm sure you also want to add some comments on Arizona and Nevada, which are back in play in the opinion of certain pollsters. But I do want to ask Davi before he goes about polling in general and why the polling is so off and why the people who do these polls don't lose their jobs. You know, it seems to me there are three kinds of people in the world who consistently get things wrong, and yet we give them almost like soothsayer powers in a modern society. The first group being the economists, the second group being the pollsters, and the third group being the meteorologists. They just can never get anything right. They always are wrong, and they're never precise enough. And yet we give them credence in society, and we rely on them every year at Coconut.
Okay. So, look, it's a nuanced answer, right, Gareth? So the reality is that, and it's a little bit, the statement you made is slightly unfair, right? Because there were actually two distinct group of pollsters in this election, right? And I would say about 75% of the pollsters fall into the category that you described, who predicted like a high single digits win for Biden across.
Yeah, it was the whole blue wave theory.
Yeah, yes. Blue wave plus 10. He carries Pennsylvania, Florida, even like Texas, etc. Right. And that was like most pollsters. Okay. So I agree they fall into that category and they just got this like shockingly wrong. Okay. But there was a different view of this election, which is like 25% of the pollsters or so, who actually saw a really tight election, like a really close election. So firstly, not all pollsters got it wrong. Okay. Yeah. Secondly, the pollsters that got closer to right, are pollsters who had a slightly different methodology in this election. And the methodological difference is correcting for the shy Trump vote. So the guys who said this is going to be a tight election are the guys who, say got like, they did their survey and the survey says, okay, Biden's going to win 55-45. But then they actually said, no, but we assume based on historic, like what happened in 2016, it's actually going to be, you know, 52-48 because some of the people who said they're going to vote for Biden are actually lying. So there are a group of pollsters who did this and they got this right, right? So I think that's the one learning from this election. But then the third thing that I'll say, which is I think important, is that the real problem is not the pollsters. I think it's the kind of media landscape which amplifies the polls that they like, right? So if you go to, for example, 538.com and like Nate Silver's analysis, right? Mm. Like they really, really emphasized the outcome of what the 70% of pollsters said and de-emphasized what the 25 or 30% of pollsters said who corrected for the shy Trump factor. So if you look at like his grading of pollsters, right? He gives pollsters like an A plus or a B or a C or whatever based on how, you know, accurate they are according to him, right? Or 538. And the guys who got like this thing out by 10 are all like the A plus pollsters, right? And the guys who actually got this right, who corrected for the shy Trump factor, are like the really low credibility pollsters according to some of the more established media houses in America. And I think that is part of the problem, is like confirmation bias. And, you know, I also think like analysis with emotion, right, is a significant part of this problem. And I want to just, sorry, long answer, but I'm just gonna say one more thing. There's just also like a real air of nastiness around everything about this. Like I'll give you an example, right? Like the day before the election, turnout data was coming out from Florida, right? And Florida was looking good for the Republicans. And I was, and we had really good Florida data and I'm really interested in Florida. So I was tweeting a lot about Florida and particularly tweeting about like the turnout patterns in Florida and it's looking good for Republicans earlier. And I was just getting like, and like totally objectively, like this is the Democratic turnout, this is the Republican turnout. And I was just getting like smacked on Twitter by like basically people who are like Biden supporters, right? Which is completely like fair. You can support Biden, but this is just like objective facts that I'm reporting. And people were like legitimately getting angry with me, right? And now on the flip side, post election, I'm sure after this conversation, now that I've said Biden is probably going to carry the election, there's going to be like a couple of Trumpsters on Twitter who are again just going to get like really, really angry with me, right? And it's like there's no more space for an objective, honest, mathematically informed conversation about this.
Well, welcome to my world.
Pumi,
145 characters is all you get.
Pums, you've got some questions and some comments here, and it's been really Davi and Canton up to now. Go ahead.
No, but I'm a big Davi fan, right? And I absolutely love the crunching of the numbers. And I saw a question earlier also saying, why would the mail-in votes be more skewed for Biden? And I think one of the things that isn't talked about enough, and I did call it for Trump, I did think it would be tight, but I did think Trump is going to win. The psychographic, we don't talk about the psychographic of who does what, right? So mm-hmm. even with the pollsters, as they're out there, those who did compensate, as Davi says, for the shy vote, the psychographic of who shows up at the polls mm-hmm. is very different to who sends in their mail votes. And the Democrats tend to mail in their votes. We talk about the turnout being huger than it's been for a long time, right? That will always tend to be the turnout, which is why when we saw, you know, when Barack Obama's campaign, at the end, his last push was just about go and vote. Because Democrats are, you know what, Democrats are lazy voters. When they feel like everything is fine, they don't show up at the polls. Right. And just leading up to this election, part of what, as they kept calling it voter suppression, we talk about how the media plays into this and how they report.
Yeah.
The fact that Donald Trump wouldn't support the post office and how the mail-in votes are working, all of those kinds of things are the things that I play here. And so when he comes out in the middle of the night to say, it's a fraud, this election's a fraud, we expected that. I mean, I don't think we expected him to say it at that time. This was very different to what we've seen all other American elections be at that time. What tends to happen is the incumbent waits for the other guy to call him and concede, and then he'll come out and speak. But Trump, Trump alluded to this in that first shambles of a debate, when his closing comments were, watch this election. They're going to try and steal this election. All my voters, go to the polls, check it out, check them out, watch them. He already at that time was alluding to the fact that there's going to be some kind of trickery at play here. And I think that the thing that we don't talk about in polite society is why Donald Trump would feel that way. What's informing that for Donald Trump? Where does he get that kind of intel? And why is it so important for him to burn down the entire system, basically?
Well, I'll give you one very quick answer, and I know Darby needs to duck, but the specific example that he used were people who ended up voting twice. So they ended up with a mail-in ballot, and then they still went to the polls as well.
So how about this quickly, because Vusi says, to Pumi's point, Biden voters voted early because they're more likely to be the ones who are more cautious about COVID. And that's an interesting thing, which obviously, again, as much as we'd like to establish a trend here, because this has been an election during COVID, we can't necessarily take this as a political trend only. It's obviously been influenced by the environment of 2020. And therefore, I think it would be very, very dangerous for either party to claim any kind of mandate from an ideological policy point of view in a year like this. Do you agree with that, Candace?
Yes, but that's not going to stop them from claiming an ideological mandate. But look, I think the lesson that we've got to take from this is that the United States needs to take a very deep look at itself. This is a country that is split down the middle, almost 50-50, and the levels of vitriol and hatred that spew across both sides for the other parties. Someone needs to actually start now taking stock. And look, I've no doubt that social media has amplified these things. These undercurrents were always there, but now the ability to spread the vitriol is just so immediate that it's become a clear and present danger. And you can understand why now the Chinese are so insistent in terms of shutting down any attempts to do the same thing in their social media spaces. Now, obviously, I'm not advocating for a distinctly anti-freedom of speech move like the Chinese do, but really the U.S. needs to actually take stock of this, because otherwise this is a country that's going to split itself apart.
Sure.
I don't know if this is a country that is splitting itself apart. I think what we're not considering, and over the years since the Clinton, Clinton-Trump fight, this is also a country, I think, that we're not giving enough credence to Vladimir Putin and what he has to win or gain from splitting this country apart. I think that the U.S. is tumbling as a world power, and the person who's got the most to gain is Putin. And I don't think we must discount.
No, it's actually Xi. You know, Putin. I think Putin is running to stand
hold
still.
Hold that thought, you two. Davi, just any closing comments from you? I know you've got to go, and then we'll wrap it up for Trump.
I just want one more thing. Like, this was such a close election, right? Like really, really close, and much tighter than I confess, I thought it would be close, but not this close. And it's actually just amazing to reflect that, you know, if Trump was like 5% saner, or just more like controlled or disciplined, like I would have won this election. Like, honestly, there's like suburban counties outside Milwaukee, right, where if he just got what he got last time, if he lost like 5% fewer, you know, educated suburban women, and just stood up in the debate and like made like sort of roughly not crazy sounding comments.
Right.
I think he would have had this, and just a little bit of more discipline, and this was a Trump election, I think. which is actually kind of, you know, interesting to reflect on. But anyway, yeah.
Well, Davi, it's good to have your insights. I'm sorry that we didn't get to hear your thoughts about Tito Mboweni and about the fiscal cliff, which is something that we've reached in this country, but we'll have to save that for another time. I'm going to talk to Pumi and Canton about those. Thanks, Davi. Great to see you again. Davi Scott.
Bye-bye. Right. Cheers. Cool.
So Pums and Canton, let's bring it home for a second, because I don't think that the U.S. elections is a fait accompli for either side yet, and there will be many court challenges, as you've already indicated, Canton. I know Pumi agrees with that. So let's just look at this fiscal cliff situation. Again, not something new to the Burning Platform. It's something we've discussed over and over again, even to the point now where the politicians themselves, who usually live in their alternate reality, they have had to come to terms with the fact that in this week, Parliament were told that now civil servant salaries, social grant payments, and debt service costs are soaking up absolutely every cent of government revenue. We did talk last week about how much debt we are accruing on a daily basis, something like 2 or 2.4 billion rand a day, which means really that this SAA thing is a drop in the ocean. But there is going to be a point where the reality, the fiscal reality, hits for our politicians. Do you think that we're closer than we've ever been to that? Do you think it's ever going to make any difference? And do you think it'll actually start to make for them to force them to make policy changes and to come to terms with these things? Or do you think it's just going to continue to spiral out of control? I mean, put me
guys, I've been saying for the longest time, our pension funds are still there. There's still money to be stolen. It's not all been stolen yet. Once our pension funds are gone, then we can talk about the fiscal cliff, but it's not there yet.
Pums, you look indignant.
Yeah. You see, I think what you have, the starting point has got to be, what do you think they will do with that reckoning? So for the most of us, when reality hits, it means that we have to recalibrate and rethink how we're doing things. Most people. And what our government has demonstrated to us over and over again is that it takes a very long time for them to get to a point of having to rethink and recalibrating and just hope it'll get better. They hope it'll get better. And when Catherine says, but our pension funds are still there, that's because I don't believe that we have anybody at the wheel there that is making enough sense to enough people for a change to happen, for action to be taken in a recalibrating or recalibrated way. I don't think that that's there.
That's kind of depressing. That's very depressing. I don't even know how to begin with that. Pumi, you've been watching the Zondo Commission this week. Do you want to give us a synopsis of what Dudu Mieni and this other lady who I've never heard of before today, who suddenly made her appearance and shows us just how absolutely terrible that board must have been. That board must have been among the most frustrating places on earth to find yourself.
I do want to start by saying that when you make fit cooks, you don't put baking powder, you use yeast.
I don't get the analogy because I don't know how to bake. Canton thinks that's funny. Explain it to those of us who don't know anything about cooking.
Well, there was a very interesting analogy she made about why they chose a particular strategy with regard to how they're going to with regard to how they're going to spend the money that is there to be spent. And the analogy she made was about why would I leave my child fed cook here in the house and go and buy the fed cooks next door? Because, you know, if there's a problem with my child's fed cooks, I must tell them how to change them here or there. And to which Zondo's face kind of like dropped. And he was just like, I don't know what's happening right now. I don't know what you're talking about. But can you hear yourself? There was even a moment where Judge Zondo's response to one of the answers was, are you sure that is the answer you want to give us right now? It's like watching a train wreck in slow motion, because what was laid bare to all of us is exactly how much meddling exists in these various boards. The people that are put into those boards are put there specifically for the job of ensuring that patronage of a certain kind is rampant. And it was just astounding. But another thing that was fascinating that came out, and a lot of people may not have known this going into, but how the EFF, Canton often talks about how you cannot look at the EFF separately and differently from the ANC, how the EFF is also used as a little bit of a scare tactic of getting people to do stuff. So there's a submission by Ms. Gwenana in her affidavit of how at a point where they were compelling one of the procurement officials to sign a particular document, giving a tender to an as yet unnamed consortium, which would be in party with Engen, right? So just understand this. Engen has agreed to it. They're going to get this 10-year deal, and they're going to get it and share it with some consortium that they have no idea who this consortium is. So understand the complicity of big business, big established multinational business with all of these shenanigans too. And when the gentleman refused to sign this letter of appointment because it was just outside of the scope of the way procurement works, and also because he didn't know who the other party is and there was no process followed, he was then threatened with the fact that he is a foreign national, Zimbabwean to be specific, and that they are aware that he is a Zimbabwean, and they're going to hand him over to the EFF to deal with him.
Wow.
As a foreigner in this strategic position.
That is an extraordinary, extraordinary admission and such a hideous threat.
And now consider at the same time that Tito Mboweni posts a picture of himself having a meal with Lesecha Kanyako, and they happen to be joined by Wesene Ndlozi at that meal, where he calls him a very nice man, or a very nice boy, sorry.
Yeah, this is actually rotten, rotten, rotten. But I mean, we can't avoid the obvious conclusion of seeing people like Dudu Mieni and the others who were on that SAA board, and seeing the very deep despair into which CADA deployment has plunged us, and into which these politically influential people are included in the business of state, where they actually have no experience in business. I mean, the one woman is a chartered accountant. You would think that there would be a certain level of understanding and of integrity and of ethical compliance if you're a chartered accountant. Clearly not. I mean,
is she in fact a chartered accountant?
That's what we believe.
I know she's presented herself as one. But, someone needs to check with the SA Institute of Chartered Accountants to see whether she is in fact one.
Just a quick correction. Bongani is just letting us know. Canton, it wasn't actually Mbuyiseni, it was Floyd who joined them for lunch.
Was it Floyd? Okay. I humbly apologize. All these EFF types look the same to me. Oh. It's the red berets that makes them all look the same.
Right, you know, sometimes what people present themselves as and what other people seem to believe people to be. Kent, and I saw you posting the other day a picture of yourself atop a mountain with a certain Palo Jordan, and I'm reminded of a very fascinating set of events around the qualifications of people, because that's what happens, right? If somebody calls you something, and then the next person, and you don't correct them, and 20 years down the line, it is revealed that you know. As everybody calls you a chartered accountant or a doctor, so and so, you are actually, you know, that, oh, it was a misunderstanding that happened down there, and I just, you know, now just become common cause. So those kinds of things are always right, Kenton.
you're reminding me of, you know, 30 years ago when I was working at the research center in Sardinia, and they insisted on calling me Dr. Pillay, and I kept correcting them and saying, no, I actually do not have a doctorate, you know, but they would insist on calling me Dr. Pillay because I was teaching 5 PhD candidates, which was kind of an interesting turn of events.
Yeah. Yeah, it's amazing how, like,
the trick is to not actually get hung up on things like that. It's kind of like the entire thing about, you know, Steenhuisen only has, you know, whatever qualifications he's supposed to have. No, actually, I don't really care. You know, Zuckerberg dropped out. The founder of Dell dropped out. Steve Jobs dropped out. Yeah, come on, guys. Let's get real.
But we can't. No. But we cannot compare a high school dropout to a, you know, an Ivy League dropout. You can't. You just can't. Just because there's the word dropout doesn't equate the two. Zuckerberg dropped out.
I do happen to know that Steenhuisen went to a relatively good private school in the vicinity of Durban, and I know this because I have a picture of him in the school lineup with my nephew who was in class with him. In fact, let me get that and tweet it. I know it doesn't change the fact, but my specific point is right now, if you look in terms of the quality of people that one gets out of South African universities, and I might have told this particular story before, but back when I was running YFM and I was looking to hire someone who was going to do compliance, because I was doing all of the engagement with the Broadcasting Complaints Commission and the National Association of Broadcasters. And so I wanted a lawyer, and I put out a very specific brief that I was looking for a lawyer who had served articles and had right of appearance.
Right.
Okay, so that I could actually, you know, cover multiple bases at the same time. And I ended up interviewing about 30 women for the job. And out of that lot, and I gave them a very simple task. I said, I want you to draft a letter to employee X saying that they are in breach of their contract for the following reasons, and you are calling them to a disciplinary hearing. And it was a very simple thing. Now, consider these are people with LLBs. They have served their articles, you know, completed being candidate attorneys, as they now call them these days. Mm. And out of that 30, only two could string a sentence together to write a letter properly.
And these are law. These are people who've passed a law degree.
These are people who've passed, and they have right of appearance to go and represent you in court.
Yeah, I mean, listen. I always say that social media is not a great indicator of how literate our population is. But my God, that's a frightening thing to come to terms with. Is the fact that even people who have degrees from tertiary education institutions might not be able to put together something cogent in writing. Hang on a second, because Adam Habib made this astonishing revelation this morning. I mean, occasionally he speaks out, and most of the time he makes some sense. And I think Adam Habib is one of those people who, by and large, does say reasonable things. But this morning he said, or it was perhaps said yesterday, that, you know, we really need to evaluate the quality of the kind of people that we have in public service. And I think he's probably referring to what he's been seeing at the Zondo Commission, like the rest of us have. Because there is generally a huge deficit. And remember, we pay, on average, more in the public sector than we do in the private sector for people who do the same kinds of jobs. And yet we get a lower standard of quality and capability from the state than we do from private enterprise. This is surely something that we need to consider. And I know that it's no revelation. I mean, I was teasing Adam Habib when I read the article this morning, because you don't have to be the vice chancellor of a university to look around and see that. But what do you think of the quality, particularly since we now see this fiscal cliff discussion, how much the state costs us, how much the people who were employed in the state cost us? What do you think of the quality of public service in this country?
This is a trick. You go, Pumi.
Especially with respect to the fact that you went to the bank yesterday, a private institution, and you had equally ridiculous service. What do you think?
That's exactly what I was going to bring up. Last week I was saying this, and I'm actually always saying this. You know, the rigor and the quality of people that we allow. I've said this before, I work with private sector clients and I work with public sector clients, and I see the same level of incompetence. Unfortunately, it is what we have allowed of ourselves in this country, all the way from the varsities. So Adam Habib is no better. He produces these people. Mm-hmm. It is his university that produces these people. We have allowed ourselves, and we must take the blame, we have allowed ourselves to drop our standard of expectation. So when you choose to walk away instead of complain, when you choose to walk away or instead of holding people to a higher standard of service, of delivery, of in private sector and in the public sector, then we must accept that the blame is within us. The blame is with us. And we have all allowed ourselves to dumb ourselves down. We really have.
Yeah.
And so that's what, you know, when we mollycoddle our kids, when we fight with the teachers, when we don't, all of that stuff, guys.
There's a cost. There's a cost down the road.
Negative.
It builds up. So what do you think, as both of you are parents, and I want to turn this into something around the personal, because it came up in a conversation I had with someone the other day. You both have children. I've always mocked and ridiculed people who homeschooled their kids, because I always thought that those kids ended up a bit weird. They certainly were when I was a kid, and maybe that's just because homeschooling has developed in leaps and bounds, whereas state schooling has probably gone backwards. What do you think of the fact that people still entrust their children's education to the state? And do you think that's still the best way forward? And both of you having had to make these decisions for your own children, do you think that there's going to be an upswing in not only private education, which we know we can measure an upswing in, but in homeschooling? And especially since the coronavirus has hit, how many parents are going to look at what kinds of things their kids have been learning for the first time this year and go, I don't see why I should be paying for this. This is outrageous. Or worse, I don't see why I should abdicate responsibility for my child's basic education to someone like Angie Mocheca and this curriculum. What do you think of that?
I think it's already happening to a far larger extent than people are actually aware of. So I know of very specific cases, particularly among my extended tribe in Durban, where people have been setting up these homeschool clusters, where essentially all of the kids go through to the home of a particular parent who ends up supervising them through the process of their coursework. And the fact of the matter is that so much of this is now available online, you know, in terms of the most important stuff that you need to study. So that's maths, history, geography, all of that type of stuff.
Sure.
You end up getting access to through the likes of Khan Academy, as an example.
Yes.
And really what's required is for someone to actually steer them through the process of the discipline of actually sitting down and concentrating on a particular subject for a specific time every day. It's already happening. And, you know, for the rest of us, if you have to have a choice, we've spoken about this happening in Khayelitsha, for example, where there have been private schools that have been set up in Khayelitsha that are parents are basically paying to send their kids to these private schools. They reasonably priced private schools by and large, but you know, certainly not at the level that one pays up here in the Joburg northern suburbs. But people are choosing to do that. And again, these are being set up by teachers who have decided to actually bail from the whole corrupt government school SATU framework, set up their own schools. And, you know, consider that if you have a handful of students pulled together and each of them is paying on the order of 1,000 rand a month, which is kind of the prices that parents in the townships are paying right now for these services, you can actually have that teacher ending up eking out a reasonably comfortable living without needing to put up with the possibility of being stabbed when they go to school.
What do you think? The
morality of that, guys. Can you hear me?
Yeah,
I keep getting sabotaged by technology here.
No problem. No, we can hear
you. Can you hear me?
Perfectly.
Okay. Yeah. You know, the immorality of that option is the fact that what it does is it makes the gap bigger and bigger. Because consider that there are many, 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 many parents in this country who do not have that basic education, to be able to take their children through a homeschooling experience. And I often tell people about my schooling experience and how difficult it was, because I was at a school whose medium of instruction was a language that nobody I know or nobody outside of my school environment spoke. And what that meant is that it was very difficult for my parents to support me or participate in any of the home-based learning that I needed to do, because they did not speak the language. So consider then that a lot of parents in this country, the basic education they were exposed to was inadequate. That's why we had the 1976 uprisings, isn't it? It's because of the quality and difference of education, right? Education system. And you're expecting that those parents who are the parents, right? They are the 40, 50 year olds who are the parents of those kids. And the kids who missed out on education in the 80s because this country was burning. Those
Pumi,
are the parents that you Pumi, want to put
Pumi. Hey. Once again, you're making the mistake of assuming the fact that I'm observing that something is happening does not mean it's something that I'm pushing for. Now, you have to understand that this is a result of the fact that some parents, and ultimately, I think, you know, you and I can both agree that every parent is going to do the best that they can actually do for their children, given the limited resources that are actually available to them. And that's what's happening. And it's a failure on the part of the state that has resulted in this happening.
Look, the observation is correct. I'm not saying that it's not what is happening. I'm simply saying that it will increase the gap. So where we complain today about the standard and the level of service that we get out of the state and the people that are in the system, it is going to get worse. It is going to get worse, and it's immoral. And we have to hold this is why we have to hold our government accountable for these things.
But ultimately, the people who need to hold them accountable are those very same parents.
And
they need to hold them accountable by voting someone else.
For voting for better policies. But that's the battle. You know, I love the fact that Joe Biden's last campaign messages were the battle for the soul of our country, right? But that's the battle that South Africans, that's the battle for the soul of our country as South Africans too. That's why it's so important that we are knowledgeable of what it is that is happening in those state institutions and then make the decisions that will make the change, because
It's so ironic that for many parents, the first time they've had to take an interest in some of this stuff is now during this coronavirus. It took something like this to force parents to actually take an interest. Some parents, I mean, obviously there are good and bad parents. I'm not going to lump everyone together. And some parents have been helping their kids with homework and things from day one, and they take an interest in these things. Some parents go overboard and do their homework for their children, which is a whole other problem we could discuss. But it's interesting that this is the year where for many parents, for the first time, they actually inspected the level and quality and curriculum of the education their children are receiving. And for many of them, it was a shock.
There, you know, the homeschooling thing, and I kept saying, and jokingly at times, but the truth is, I am a terrible teacher. I am a terrible teacher. And what it did, and why I send my child to school, and even as I reassess the curriculum and how things work all the time, and I've been on the journey with my child in schooling, I know that my relationship with my child, if I am to be the primary caregiver and also the teacher, our relationship, the total breakdown of our relationship is not worth it, right? And Catherine, don't laugh. I couldn't, even when he was little, I couldn't deal with a guy who couldn't write his name. All of these things are just like, and you've got to acknowledge that too, right? That there's a place and there are people who can do that and there are people who can't, no matter how much interest I take.
Okay, guys, you know, let me toss in an argument that I've been having for literally the past 20 years, because 1999, when I was managing editor of the Cape Times, and I wrote a scathing piece about SATU and education back then. And everyone said, oh, you're so smart. Well, why don't you give us a solution in terms of how you can fix it? And I said, fine, I will. And I put together a plan making use of technology at the time, which was basically satellite TV technology. And my idea was very simple. You hire people who are mother tongue instructors, and you pay them, you actually get the best possible mother tongue instructors that you can get. You pay them very well, and you run centralized schooling in a TV studio up in Gauteng, and you broadcast those classes simultaneously across the entire country, and just have TV sets in the classrooms or in people's homes. And we all know that nothing actually works better for early childhood development than mother tongue instruction. And I've lost track of the number of doors that I knocked on with actually putting this thing forward. I said, all of the technologies here, it actually just requires will on the part of government to pull it together. I put a copy in Thabo Mbeki's hand, and I said, look at this thing. This is a way in which you actually end up fixing our education. But remember that everyone in government, they have a vested interest in keeping the existing structures in place. They have no interest whatsoever in tearing it apart because it's an opportunity to loot.
Let's just go to this quickly. There are lots of comments about this. So we've clearly hit a nerve, and we haven't really discussed this much on the Burning Platform because we always focus on the political, which I think is probably a mistake. Khotso says a qualification, even a degree from a university, is just a piece of paper. It doesn't mean you can actually do the job, and I think that's referencing Canton's search for a lawyer all those years ago. Ruth says, these are the things that I discuss often, and she says, some of the wealthiest people in the world never finish school. Beth says, I'm expecting to see a huge uptick in homeschooling co-ops, which is, I think, what we've been talking about. And Nikki says, thanks to some, there's a trust apparently. Some parents are homeschooling using their own curriculum and not CAPS. So lots and lots of comments about this. I thought it might
also... I think I just want to respond to the issue of dropouts mm-hmm. and school. Mm-hmm. The basic function of education is, in some aspects, technical.
Yeah.
But the most basic function is about cognitive skill. It's learning how to think. It's learning how to problem solve. That's what it's for. It's to give you the tools to solve the problems that you encounter. There is no curriculum in the world that gives you every single problem and how to fix it. What it gives you is it gives you the thought process, it gives you the practice of the thought process of how to solve those problems. That's what school is supposed to do. And part of the reason why we have, and I will stand by this, guys. We cannot say a person, the wealthiest people in the world didn't finish school. Which part of school did they not finish? Bloody hell. When Bill Gates chooses to leave an Ivy League tertiary institution, it is because his business that he's got in his backyard is growing, and it requires him there more than what he is going to still learn at school. Secondly, the fact that people forget the idea that Bill Gates went to a high school where his mother was on the board, and they had the most sophisticated computer lab at his school because his mother sat on a board with the chairperson of IBM at the time. Yeah. So yeah, Bill Gates is a dropout, but fuck me, he's not a high school dropout from some private school in Durban. Come on.
Now I'm with you. That's totally true. Final word for this morning comes from Mbulelo, our own Mbulelo, who says, we live in a scientifically illiterate nation. You can't expect Sally in Sandton to teach chemistry and mathematics to her kids. Forget about a largely Bantu-educated adult citizenry, which I think is Tupumi's point earlier. And then finally, this is, I think you'll like this, Pums. This is a suggestion I asked you earlier. What is the Zulu Karen's name? And the suggestion from Brendan is, a Zulu Karen is a Tandega.
No, Tandega. doesn't have that fight.
All right.
Talladega doesn't have that fight. I'm going to think about it and I'll bring it back to you next week.
Yeah, look, hopefully by next week we know who the next president of the United States is. If it takes longer than that, we may actually see a lot of instability in the world markets. We may see lots of craziness happening. But one thing I think we can all be assured of is that the panic and the political pressure behind coronavirus will start to dissipate in the U.S. Now that the election is over. I think that's unavoidable. But I thank you both.
Bitcoin has gone to 14,000.
Yeah, Bitcoin, so. Yeah, that's right. Bitcoin is steeply on the up. Pums?
Please can I share an economist sentiment that's on Twitter this morning? If Joe Biden wins the presidency, a Republican Senate majority, which is looking more likely, so if you're looking at those, the House and the Senate, promises another 4 years of gridlock and hyper-partisan dysfunction in America. And I'm going to bring it to you again to say the world superpower is tumbling those feet of clay. The what we're going to see in the next 4 years is we're going to see some seriously tectonic shifts as to who the power players in the world are. Meanwhile, Tito Mboweni is busy with garlic.
Yeah, while Rome burns. Thanks, guys. Pumi, Canton, always good to have you both on. Thank you to our guest, Darby Skultz, for this morning. And most importantly, thank you to you for listening. Otherwise, we'd be doing this for our own enjoyment, which, trust me, is not good
enough. I've just tweeted a link to that piece, by the way, Garrett.
Thank you. Your education piece.
Yep.
All right, there it is. You want to look back into the past and see how Canton already had foreseen these problems then? You'll understand why we have him on the burning platform every week, because he can see into the future. Let's reconvene next Thursday. Thank you, guys. Thanks very much. CliffCentral.com.
Ciao.
CliffCentral.com.